Blog Talk Radio. I got a few people sending me some email messages, and I sent them the phone number. I see we got Art and Pete in the house. If anyone wants to call in, go ahead. But I want to play this one thing first. I just got this from Australia, and I think it's pretty important. It's about 9 minutes long, and then after that, I'll open up the phone lines. But what this is this. I put it in the chat, but it's called Inside the Bikey Bunker, and it's on a program called The Hungry Beast. And what I'll do is I'll pop that in the chat room right now, and if you guys want to check it, I'll give you the email address or the YouTube address. Everything's in there right now. I see we lost Art. Some people are bouncing in and out. I can't help that. But trying to deal with Blog Talk on what's going on. Sometimes you can get the chat. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes the phone line goes dead. Sometimes it doesn't. But I'm going to start this right now. This is called Inside the Bikey Bunker.
It contains material that is not recommended for persons under 15 years.
A year ago this week, Hell's Angel associate Anthony Zervis was bashed to death in full public view in a bikie brawl at Sydney's domestic airport. It prompted a police crackdown on bikie gangs as governments around the country developed controversial new laws to tackle the clubs. In response, the bikies set up state councils to unite against the proposed new laws. Tonight, in a Hungry Beast exclusive, Jessica Mendez goes inside the New South Wales Bikey Bunker.
This is a meeting of the United Motorcycle Council of New South Wales. Every 2 weeks, the leaders of self-described outlaw clubs like the Hells Angels, Nomads, Six, and Rebels meet with Christian and military clubs like God Squad and the Vietnam Veterans.
From the last meeting, we had Margaret here from the PR company. She's talking to us about the ABC. They're here tonight.
After the Sydney airport bashing, the bikies became concerned that new gang laws would threaten all clubs equally. Bikie councils were formed across the country. In New South Wales, 18 clubs united to lobby against the laws and help resolve disputes. The council also hired a PR company to address what everyone here conceives is a serious image problem. How do you guys think the public see you?
They're blind. They don't see who we are. Like, we're the average person. We just got an interest in bikes.
They see what they want to see.
Yeah.
They see us as criminals.
It does seem to a lot of people like you guys enjoy that, having that really sort of...
Doesn't that sound like what's going on here? Every day.
Menacing and scary image.
I think people get scared because they know if they fuck around with us, we have brothers that will back us up. We're not going to let a brother bleed when we're not bleeding.
And what sort of disagreements do you guys have?
Respect. You've got to respect to each other. If you don't show respect, you don't get it in return.
Anyone want to add to that?
A lot of it comes down to perceived lack of respect on one party or another, or actual lack of respect from one party to another. We're trying to get a hold of that, as you can see here. So
yeah, there's no truth to it. We all have to understand that if we keep continuing arguing with each other, that the world's going to end.
Under the New South Wales government's criminal organisation laws, members of a club can now be placed under a control order and banned from working in around 15 different professions. Those include security, tow truck driving, running a bar, and being a mechanic.
There's not a lot stopping them adding things to that list either. I mean, they're constantly amending laws.
Well, we can do an experiment. I can tell you who I work for, and we'll see how quickly they put that on the list. But
the laws also ban them from associating. Meeting another member under a control order would result in automatic arrest.
Anybody who's seen with us, a class is associate.
So fundamentally now, you're a bike bitch.
Yes.
These men want us to know they see the legislation as an infringement of their civil rights and ours.
the fact that any group of people can be subject to the legislation, the fact that criminal intelligence can be used against you and you're not going to be in court to hear what it is, so you can't defend yourself, this is really a dangerous piece of legislation.
But the police maintain tough laws are necessary and that bikie clubs are organised crime units. The bikies see it differently.
That's one thing that the media beef up and everything. So like I said before, if you ever went to one of our meetings, we're not that organised. The way that police dress us all up, that there's one bloke at the top, he hands the drugs out and we all go out and feed it all out like an organiser. That doesn't happen.
Police would argue, though, that certainly there are individuals within a lot of clubs that are involved in criminal activity.
Yeah, we've got people in the club that are. So is a football club team down the road.
So is our
police force. Are they an organised crime unit?
Not everyone's buying the idea that relations between the clubs are as relaxed as they seem in this room. According to a recent article, a bikie war is still simmering.
That's just more police propaganda. Nothing's been happening, so paper sales would be down. It's like a soap opera. They want to read the next instalment.
Is that a joke with the Angels? You read that article, apparently we're going to war over if tattoo parlours would both own. But we know nothing of this. It's a complete blow-up. That was a, I just want to keep writing a saga about it.
I don't think the public realise we're fathers, we're grandfathers.
How many people here have kids?
They made about our wives having Gucci bags. I said, my wife ain't got a Gucci bag.
Every time something comes up about the big bad bikies, I've noticed car drivers are more likely to sit up your backside when you're on your bike. They see someone with a patch on their back and they go, oh, beauty, let's hassle him. Why? I've got a wife at home I want to get home to.
To listen to a fart.
You know, when she watches this, when this comes out, she's going to kill me, you know? Why do you think I'm wearing long sleeves? She bashes me. I'm in bruises.
Take a good example. There's a difference. Because we've got a back patch on, we are 1% club in the eyes of the police. Hotels and everything else, we're treated exactly the same. We wear a back patch with pride because we served in Vietnam. We came back and we were ostracised by the government, by everyone when we came back. At least the bikies give us a chance. We fought for this country and we cop all the shit.
The council is keen for us to understand.
Does that sound familiar too?
And that bikies are just like you and me. But some of the men here see violence and lawlessness in a very different way to most Australians.
Our attitudes are pretty old and raw. We deal with what we deal with. There's so many people out there that walk the earth would love to be able to go bop someone over the back of the head with a bat because he pissed him off. We just do it our way.
Violent disagreements between rival clubs have been kept to a minimum over the past year. Regular council meetings mean clubs are increasingly answerable to each other, and no one wants to be to blame for a repeat of last year's events.
In March last year, a man was killed at the airport in front of a lot of very scared members of the public. I know it's before the courts and there's a sub judice issue here, but is there anything that you can say to the public about it?
It's got to be said that what happened at the airport was a tragedy. But the fact of the matter is, you open the newspaper any day of the week and you're reading about similar sorts of stories that don't continue getting the same thing. It's there one week and it's wrapping your chips the next week or whatever. And the whole story just goes away in that particular time. This one hasn't, because they're motorcyclists. It's the stigma attached with this particular group of people, and not because of anything else.
You look what else happens in the world. Get over it. Build a bridge.
It's moments like these that make you wonder if a PR strategy will be enough to save the bikies. In the meantime, the irony of being brought together by laws designed to keep them apart hasn't escaped anyone.
In a way, the government helped us come together. The police want to tear us apart and have us fighting, and the government, in the same light, pulled us together or pushed us together.
Since this interview, it's been reported that the New South Wales Police are moving to declare the first club illegal. It's not clear how long the council and the relative calm it has brought will last.
All right, anyway, civil rights meeting closed. Hello?
Hello, caller.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Philip.
I'm gonna bring in a couple people you might know. Hold on a second. Hello, Pete.
Hey, Phil. What's happening?
Not much. Say hello to Carrie.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
How are you?
Is that you, Pete?
Yes,
oh,
it is.
Oh, Carrie.
Yeah. Hold on 1 minute. Hold on 1 second, both of you. Hello, caller.
Yes.
330.
Yes, from Ohio. I'm Lisa.
How you doing, Lisa?
I'm great.
I got Lisa on the show tonight, Phil. I sent her the link, and I said it's a great show, and she'd enjoy it. So here she is. Thanks
yes,
for calling in.
That's good. I hope we can. I hope I can pull this off by myself tonight. Otherwise, Bill will be here Thursday with me. Usually on Tuesdays, he's taking care of his mom for a couple more weeks, and then he'll be back.
We'll pull it off, brother. We'll pull it off.
So, Carrie, how's things in Scotland?
Yeah, hi, everybody. Hope you're having a lovely night. And it's brilliant to get through to the show, and I hope you all have a really, really good night.
Well, thank you for calling and taking the time to call.
No, I don't mind. Usually, obviously it's during the night here in Scotland, when the show's on. But I especially stayed up just to watch the show, listen to the show, so... I can't wait to listen to it now.
Okay, good.
Hey, Carrie.
Yeah?
You know who this is, right?
Sorry?
You know who this is, right? You know who I am, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Nice to hear your voice.
And yours as well.
Thank you for the nice comments.
That's no problem.
Yeah, that's Pete out of Boston. So, Lisa, what's going on in Ohio?
It is cold, and it's raining, and I'm ready to ride. The sun needs to shine here.
So, I hate to be the boss here because I'm not the boss, but I had Lisa calling for a reason. Lisa has quite a big story, and some things to share with us.
Okay.
And her experience with all the... you know, the clubs and the scene and all that, so.
Uh-huh.
Thank you for calling, Lisa.
No problem.
I know you talked last night, but, you know, or the night before, but I thought it'd be a good chance for you. You know, I wanted you to come on the show. I'm glad you called in. I'm very happy.
Uh-huh.
And I'm very happy that my friend in Scotland called in.
That's awesome. That's really awesome.
My friend in Scotland sounds a little depressed tonight. You okay, Carrie?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. You know, I haven't been feeling well myself, so I'm not myself, you know. But I do my best. I do my best.
That's all you can do. You sound great.
Huh? What's that?
You sound great. I'm just shy. I'm from Scotland.
You were not shy away last time, Carrie.
I've seen your website. You're really shy, uh-huh.
Yeah, I know.
Hey, wait,
hell
but
yes,
it's your story. You tell it any way you want.
Hey, Carrie, when you were on a hammer show with me, you weren't too shy.
Yes, I was.
Well, you know what? There might have been a full moon that night.
Come on.
I have my ups and downs, so anyway,
mm-hmm.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Lisa, for calling in. Thank you, Carrie, for calling in. Thank you, Phil, for inviting me.
And I thank all of you for calling in, but we got one quick update we're going to do from Las Vegas. And
yeah.
Then we'll listen to Lisa's story, and maybe we can help her out with some info. And then, Carrie, if you got anything you want to sound in on, just chime in. And what everybody to do is just say who you are or where you're calling from, and then we'll go from there. But right now, I'm going to bring in Tiger Lily about Las Vegas. I'll leave everybody unmuted so you can listen. If you want to make a question or anything, just say who you are, and we'll go from there, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
All right. Hello, Tiger Lily.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Right now we have Carrie from Scotland, Lisa from Ohio, and Pete from Boston.
Cool. Oh, I went to London and rented a Harley Davidson and went through England to the with the bathhouses and I had just been riding a motorcycle for 6 months and I had a girlfriend with me. I'm not a lesbian. I'm happily married, but my girlfriend and I went over there. Not that there's anything wrong with that. So we went all over to the bathhouses and where the henge, what is it, that stone thing, and in London. It was just, we had such a blast. But so anyways, and I went another time with another girlfriend, and we took the whole tour, the bus tour from London to Scotland and Ireland and Wales and then back, like the whole circle. And oh my God, just give me a little alcohol, and you know, it has to be rum. I'm very funny with rum. I'm violent with vodka, but the rum, oh my God, I was drinking rum. And I was killing the people.
Where did that violence happen?
Well, it was in the bus. You know, we'd stop places, and then at one point I got so drunk we went to it was Loch Ness. Is that in Scotland? The Loch Ness?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay. I took the little riverboat thing there in Loch Ness, and I was in the bottom of there. They had like a whole bar in there. So I'm like drinking scotch, I think it was, and I was killing them. And then the host that was running the bus, he was wearing a skirt. You know how they do the you Scottish people with the kilt. A kilt, yes. And I was so drunk, I says, "Hey, what you got under there?" You know, and stuff like that. And then I says,
"I bet you had nothing under there."
I don't know, but he was real. He's a very Britishman, you know. And so, and I was all drunk, and I was, like, totally disgracing the whole United States America of America. And I says, well, you know, you ought to go al fresco. As a matter of fact, you know, my husband would probably go al fresco because he blow dries his balls every morning before he goes to work.
Oh, my God. Oh, my
know, really?
God.
And I says, when I the first time I ever saw him blow drying his balls, I'm like, what? WTF, honey, what is that? He goes, well, you never see me with jock itch, do you? So I just get to prevent. So the next morning, I'm still a little hungover, and I'm in the bus, and my the host that previously was wearing a skirt, was wearing his regular clothing. He says, every day he'd say, okay, today we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to dine here and we're going to have a 3 or 5 or 7 course meal and complimentary wine. Well, this time he says, and complimentary wine for everybody except Lily. And everybody's here, but they all loved me.
You know what? I think you're actually Scottish, by the way.
Really?
I think deep down you should be Scottish. Yeah.
I just loved the whole experience. I love meeting, going to different places. And my husband hates traveling because he's like 6'4" and has like a gigantic watermelon head. So he hates wandering. So that's why I have to go with a girlfriend.
Your sense of humor is so Scottish. Please come back to Scotland and we will start.
And I noticed that. And when I was in, I think it's York, England, I reported back to the bus chairperson or whatever, and I said, you know, I heard somebody say the F word, but it was really cool the way they said it. They say, fuck, you know, and because, you know, we say fuck, right? And he said, well, yeah, they're very proper there, you know, and they still use the old English, you know, like thou and thee. And I says, oh, so I wish somebody would say fuck thee. You know, that was a good thing. I want to fuck thee. I haven't even had anything to drink, Phil. I said to my
so
husband,
much for what happened in Vegas stays in Vegas, huh?
I hear that.
Oh, no, I'm going to, honey, it stays in Vegas unless I know about it, because it's going to be completely out of the closet if I hear about it. Let me tell you what happened. First of all, you should know I have a little YouTube that has literally gone viral. It's a 34-second clip. that shows that I was open carrying. Well, it doesn't show I was open carrying, but it shows where I came upon two violent police officers that they weren't violent at the time, but I had some reason to suspect that they were up to no good. So I put my I had a dog in one hand and the camera in the other hand, and I was openly carrying. That for the Scottish people, that means we carry our guns, that you can show our guns. That I carry a .45 with me at all times. In Nevada, it's legal to do that. So as I approached them, I was videotaping, and they came at me with their hands on their guns and told me to put it down. So I got handcuffed, and I'm like, oh, my God, I've never been handcuffed, not even for fun, in my whole life. I'm 50. And so I've never been in trouble, not even in trouble with the law or anything. So they detained me and handcuffed me for 56 minutes. So I put that on YouTube. Literally, I put it on April the 23rd. I've gotten over 2,400 hits on it already. And I've engaged a local reporter, and I'm giving her first dibs because she's somebody that knows somebody that I know. And so she's doing a little investigative, and I'm helping her, feeding her all this information. Because what's going on in Nevada and really throughout the country, what is your name out there in Scotland?
Carrie? Yeah.
Okay. What's going on here is, and it's happening throughout the world. I mean, we've got civil unrest, we've got economy that's crappy, and people, are, you know, and the more that the governments are losing in revenue, the harsher they become to the citizens, and that's what's going on here in Nevada. That we are the state that is the most in debt in the entire country, and because the law enforcement agencies have been losing so much money in revenue and stuff, what they're doing is they're giving us more citations, and they're picking on us, and motorcyclists tend to be the low hanging fruit, because a lot of us, you know, we don't know our rights, and you know, a lot of us, you know, have Harleys and, you know, wear tattoos, and we're just all about the freedom and the fun and the pot, you know. So they're out to get us. And so what I witnessed, we had probably the largest Southwest motorcycle event this weekend, and it was the Laughlin River Run. It's famous. It's internationally famous. And I witnessed these cops violating the rights of four young men in their high teens. Like they were over 18, except for one was supposedly not quite 18 yet. And the lady that was about my age, and they were just have, you know, in the back of their truck, and just, long story short, I went in there because knowing what I know about how these cops are so violent, I got kind of up in their grill in a safe distance, and I started videotaping, you know, and this one guy said, oh, not videotaping, flashing, flash photography, because my videotape wasn't working. So the cop turns around, and he says, no pictures. And then one of the detained people says, yeah, we don't want any paparazzis. And so he said, you heard that. That comes from them. I says, all right, I respect that if you don't want me. Dave told me I should say, hey, I wonder if Rodney King wouldn't have wanted some videos. That's how you know, he got exonerated and how he probably made a fortune suing the Las Vegas, Los Angeles people. So long story short, the cops you know, they made them, they had him, the four guys handcuffed, and they hadn't done anything. And the one, and I said, well, you know, I'm a reporter for a motorcycle magazine, and they were telling me to get lost. This is none of your business. And I'm like, okay. So I kind of moved away, and then I just took a different angle, and I'm still taking pictures. And the lady that was there, she told me later on, she says, hey, is it true? Are you really a reporter? And I said, yeah. She goes, can I talk to you after this? And I said, sure, honey, I'm here for you. I ain't going nowhere. It was like midnight, and I had slept in because I know that's when the action happens at night, when the cops get the most violent. So when they got finished, she came over. She says, you know, I just feel so bad. My nephew here, he just buried his wife today, and we're here just to chill out. And they tried to get us for, you know, alcohol, and nobody was drinking. We're just here just listening to the music of the parking lot. And I says, I totally believe you because I've witnessed it myself, and I've done some undercover reporting and stuff, and I know what happened, but people don't believe it because I'm not mainstream media yet. And he said, and so she said, and that cop, that sergeant over there, he was calling you a bitch. And I said, yeah, no, I've been called worse, honey. Don't worry about that. She said, I just felt so bad for you that, you know, that they dehumanize people. I said, honey, don't even worry about that. But what I'm worried about is the violation of what they were doing. You know, you did not have to open up your car and let them go. They had the cameras in there. They were so then they broke it up. I mean, when I was there, I broke it up, And so the gal started to leave. And then the cop, and I stayed there by the cops to see who next they were going to fuck with. So that sergeant, oh, I swear to God, Phil, you guys have seen this. You know what I'm talking about. He had such a satanic look in his face, like he wanted to hurt me, like really hurt me. Like if he could have tarred and feathered me, that's what would have given him his jolly. And so he says, show me some ID. He comes over to me and I says, why? He goes, because I said, show me some ID. And I says, no, I'm not going to show you any ID. Unless you tell me that unless you think I've done something wrong, what did I do? He says, interfering with police. I says, what are you talking about? You're all by yourself here. He says, ran off some people. How are you interfering? How did I ever interfere? And then he says, well, you were taking a picture of a minor over there. That's a felony. I says, excuse me, if that was a felony, you would have already arrested me because I know you want me bad, you know? And so he says, get over there. And he made me go to the front of his squad car. He says, oh, and then I started screaming and yelling, and people started cheering in the background. And I started saying, I am a Marine Corps veteran and a reporter for Quick Draw. I got this all on audio, too. My husband's like, oh, my God, you're so obnoxious. But it was the people were getting drunk, and they were, like, far away, kind of. So that's why I had to holler so that they could hear me. And I could say, these men are violating my rights. I did not consent to them to take my purse and to open my wallet. And the motherfucker was actually sniffing. And I said, I do not consent to you sniffing my purse. Everything they did, I do not consent. Well, he opened up my wallet, and he took out the first ID that he saw, very gingerly, you know. And, of course, I wasn't even handcuffed or anything. And this one pork slob came by. I shouldn't call him a slob. He was cute as hell. He was a little Mexican like me. And he got a little closer than the rest of them, and he hollers. I said, you're my hero, lady. And then so they went to him, handcuffed him, put him in the back of the car, you know, not inside the car, but behind the car. And so, there were four cops behind me and horse cops. And so I was surrounded by cops, but I'm hollering and yelling and everything because and I'm hoping somebody's videotaping and they'll call me and say, my name is Tiger Lily, email me at the, you know, and I'm doing all of this. And so he takes my military ID. It has my maiden name and my husband's name, and that's the only time I've ever used my husband's last name, because usually I just go by Lily Gonzalez. So they looked that up and they couldn't find anything, you know, because there's nothing. So then he went back in and I kept saying, I'm a military veteran. So he went in and he found my little veteran card where I get VA services. And so it's got my name, Lillian Gonzalez. He went back into his car and called that name in. And I'll tell you what, about a minute after he took that and he saw my name, Phil, my name must be tagged or something. They immediately uncuffed the guy and let me be free to go. And they tried to do some damage control. Have a nice day, ma'am. I'm like, excuse me? So there must be something on my name, Lillian Gonzalez, that says do not fuck with her because she is more trouble than she's worth.
That's usually what they do to me.
Right, and
that
then,
never
and then they have
to
listen because they know that you're going be more trouble than they're worth. So I've got pictures.
Well, I'm sorry, guys. Sorry to put in here that, you know, in Scotland, you would get away with everything. And I feel so bad about you guys that are going through all this over there. Because in Scotland, it would mean fuck all, to be honest.
It's peaceful.
What you're
it's
going through.
Out there.
And honestly, I can't believe what you all go through over there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carrie, let me just say this, that I considered moving to another country because I believed that the United States
Scotland
of America.
Because you all get off with fuck all.
Because I don't think the United
Seriously.
States of America is so
Seriously.
Free. And,
I'm not saying fuck all. I'm saying things that don't matter, you know, like where you all get picked on over there and you all get done for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But right off. When I say what you go through or hear what you go through, it pisses me right off because in Scotland, you'd be free. Seriously.
Mm-hmm. Right. So... But I considered moving away, but then my daughter's pregnant, so she's going to deliver in a month and a half or so. So it kind of changed my whole perspective, because initially I got two kids that I didn't think were going to breed, so I thought the bloodline was going to die with them. But now my daughter decided to start breeding, so it's like, okay, I have to make this country a little better or going in the right direction before I croak. So that's what drives me. So anyways, I'm finished. I mean, there's more stuff, you know, but that was the essence of what I wanted to report to you.
Anyway, I'd just like to say that I think that it's ridiculous what y'all go through over there. Seriously.
Well, it's worse. Here's what people have to understand out there. What happens on the East Coast, it goes through the country, happens on the West Coast. It might be a day, it might be 2 days, it might be a week, but it's coming. Whatever mm-hmm. happens on the West Coast goes east. Same thing. Like here, what they started in Australia, they're doing it in Canada, and the United States is looking at it on how they can institute it here. And if
right.
you bend over once, you're going to bend over twice. I don't give a fuck what anybody says. I'm the biggest, baddest motherfucker in the room, and nothing's going to happen.
Bending over. Bending over, Phil. I got to tell you this bending over story. When I got handcuffed those 56 minutes on April the 13th, the officer, one of the officers said, sit. And he wanted me to sit on the curb. And I said, oh, hell no. I am not going to sit. You're going to have to shove me to the ground. And if you do, I got a gigantic hemorrhoid on my ass, and I will bleed to death. So that caught him by surprise. And he says, okay, well, then just stand by the wall. So what? And I guess I shocked him so well that he didn't realize that even though I was handcuffed, I still had my camera. So I captured, there's a lot of ass shots of my butt and the wall. And at one point when they all got distracted, I turned around and I was able to capture all the cops that were there. I was surrounded by four cop cars and four cop people. One from Las Vegas Metro, and the other three were county officers. And then also a fire truck came by just for good measure to see, oh, what's going on there, brothers? You know, it's like, well, we got the...
Be sure they didn't call them to come check on your hemorrhoids.
Dave said, you are such a sport. I have a friend, my best friend is David Stillwell. She says, you are such a sport, Tiger Lily. You don't care that your ass is all on there. You don't give a shit. And I says, no. Showing my ass is secondary to exposing these motherfuckers. They have got to be exposed for what they're doing. And that's the only way we're going to beat them back. Educate people, because there's a lot of people in the United States who don't realize that we even have a problem. They're in their own little world. They go to their 9-to-5 job. They come home and watch, you know, some cartoon or something. And they don't realize that our liberties are being taken away from us, and we're allowing it. So that's what drives me. Excuse me. I'm done, Phil.
But, it's just like, it's welcome to my world, because usually I have 5 or 6 cars with 8 or 10 guys.
Yeah, I
well, that's what
too.
It was like in Laughlin, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've seen
once,
it too.
Once the fun starts, then when I want to stop cooperating, I just tell them I want to talk to the watch commander. And they go, well, that's going to be 10, 15, maybe a half hour. I go, I'm in no hurry.
Mm-hmm.
And they change their whole attitude. And then when they that guy usually shows up, depending on which day of the week it is, he just hands me my stuff and tells me to have a nice night.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, Phil, I better let you go because I got a mouthful of lasagna. Because
okay.
I told my husband, I said, is it 5 o'clock? I need a drink because I'm going to call Phil. He says,
okay.
Have you eaten anything? And I says, well, no. He says, no.
All right. Well, if you get a chance, call in Thursday.
Okay. I'll do my best. Send me an email to remind me, okay? Nice meeting you guys. Nice
you
meeting
too.
You, Carrie. And
Oh, you too, Sarah.
Great.
Take care.
Cheers, everybody.
Bye.
Okay. Hang on 1 second. Hello, 909.
Yeah.
Who's this?
Is Doc.
Hey, hold on. All right. Hey, Doc, hold on a second. We got Carrie from Scotland, Pete from Boston, Lisa from Ohio, and Doc is up in Big Bear. Hold on 1 second, all right?
All right.
Hello, 951.
Yeah, evening, screwdriver. It's Merlin.
Hey, Merlin, how you doing?
I'm doing real good.
Merlin's got a funny story, guys. Just listen up. Merlin, where are you at tonight?
I am in Tazewell.
Whoop, we lost Merlin. Hang on 1 second. Hello, caller, 773.
Hey, greetings, greetings. This is Terry Hardy.
Hey, Terry, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you guys, Phil?
Not bad. Are you in Chicago right now? You just missed Tiger Lily.
Yeah, I was listening there. I heard.
Okay. Well, right now we've got Carrie from Scotland, Pete from Boston, and Lisa from Ohio, and Doc's calling from Big Bear. And we just grabbed Merlin back from where he's at. So let me unmute him, and then we're going to listen to Carrie's story, or Lisa's story, and then we'll go from there. That way you guys, if anybody's got anything they want to add to it, or give her any info, we can go from there.
Cool.
Merlin, are you there?
I am here.
Okay, hold on, Merlin. We're gonna I'm gonna let Lisa tell the reason she called in and why, and let her tell her story. Go for it, Lisa.
Okay.
Well, I'm a widow of a one percenter, and I'm outraged at the discrimination against bikers and the fact that my husband's been gone for 3 years. And I'm still being watched, and I'm not even doing anything. I mean, I'm discriminated against because of my last name, because of my association. It doesn't matter how good I'm doing. I will always be discriminated against. And, you know, I was proud to be part of what my husband was part of. And you know, I don't understand why people always want to find the worst in people, and they can never see the good that these bikers are doing for people, and it really ticks me off.
Mm-hmm. Did you happen to hear about what? Did you listen to what I played about Australia a few minutes or at the beginning of the show?
I did hear some of it. Yes.
Okay. It's like what's happening down there is happening in Canada, and the United States is trying to figure out how they can start doing it here. California has one already. They call it the California Step Act. And basically, it's if three of us are standing together and a cop decides that we're a criminal organization and he writes a report, that starts the investigation. So when they see us with those three friends and then any other friends that we come in contact with, they all become known associates of those three guys.
Family, friends, everything, children, you name it.
That's correct.
And, you know, that's no matter what I do good in the community, I'll always be labeled.
Start hanging out with Mormons. They run in pairs. Hang out with Mormons. They run in pairs, and they'll screw the system up big time because they won't know what to do with it.
You know, what really screws them up really bad, too, is when you are doing good things and they can't find anything wrong with you, they still want to put out, they still try to find the worst in you, no matter how good you're doing. No matter how, you know, I was sick. I got cancer. I was battling cancer for 2.5 years, and they still continued to watch me. I was still labeled. I was too sick to do anything. But it does, you know, I'm in school now. I go to college. I mean, I'm doing well for myself. But it doesn't matter. I'm still
no. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
And you know, as far as getting a job or anything now, it doesn't matter. You know, I still have that label. It doesn't.
Yeah. Well, they're,
none of
they're
the
list-
things I've done in life matter anymore.
Yeah, they're listening right now.
No, that's fine. You know,
Hi guys.
You know, it's fine with me. You know, I've got nothing to hide, but it still doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it right at all.
Well, it matters to you that you're doing what's right for you and you're not hurting anybody. That matters to you, and it matters to the people who are around you and take a moment to know you. And every time you do something good, valuable, you know, just outside of what the bad cop thinks you should be doing or must be doing, it unwinds something. And it really does, you know, it does make a difference. And it's small, but you get enough sand and you get a beach. And I know it's frustrating, and I really do understand how frustrating it is. But
hi.
You're not
can
doing it for them. You're doing it for you.
Can I button?
Go ahead, Carrie. Hold on 1 second. Go ahead, Carrie.
Hi. I just wanted to say that my heart goes out to you and what you're going through and what you've been going through. And I can't honestly put myself in your shoes.
Well, you know what, Carrie?
I wish
I could. A lot more than anything is when you persevere. When you persevere and you get through it, that pisses them off more than anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but you've been going through a lot, and I can't. It's really sad for you, and
oh, don't feel bad for me because I've you know everything I've been through, I've learned from.
Yeah,
and it's only made me stronger.
Yeah, of course, but you lost your manny.
Yes, I did, but he will always be in my heart, and he will always watch after me. And
yeah,
he'll be the reason I'm alive today. I should have been dead with the cancer, and he's what keeps me going every day. He will always live in my heart, and I will always be a better person because I was with him. He taught me. He taught me a lot.
Yeah, for definite.
But I really
want to send big hugs to you from Scotland.
Well, thank you so much.
And you're very, very, very brave.
Yes, I am.
It takes a lot to go through what you have been through.
And, you know, if I wouldn't have been with the man I was with, I doubt I would have been strong enough to handle all that. But, you know, being with him and with all the discrimination and with all the people watching all the time, I think that's what gave me even more of a will to stand up and want to live.
Yeah.
Well, what they say is behind every good woman or every good man is a good woman or a good
you,
woman
honey.
Behind that. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a truth. That is the truth.
Good for you, sweetie.
Well, thank you so much. But thank you for letting me speak. I appreciate
it. No problem. If you want, you can hang out here and listen. I'm gonna bring Doc in. Doc's usually got some good stories. Doc, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Ross. How you been?
Good. What's happening?
Collecting tickets like usual. Oh, that goes. How about yourself?
Not bad. I watched them check bottles the other day for fruit flies. Seems they got a new job now, too.
Nice. You got to have a hobby, I guess, while you're on job.
Nah, they told them to get it done before the shift really got going. Wouldn't have time to do it. So they checked all the bars, and they found they went into one establishment we know, and then they went into another establishment around the corner, and they found 3 bottles in one and 10 bottles in the other. And as I followed them around while they were doing this, I asked the bartenders how long they've been trying to close these places. They didn't get it. No, they're just checking. No, they didn't get it.
Nice. Again, I'm snatching up 3 more helmet tickets out here, and one in Moreno Valley and 2, where is it, here in Paris area.
Yeah.
2 from
the
Riverside.
Well, I heard you should have went with the 12-inch bars.
Yeah. I like the 15s. They're not that bad. They're comfortable. I'm 6'8",
okay.
So they're comfortable for me. But I've been getting some more info from a gentleman up north in Sacramento area. And educate me a little bit more to the point where I have now gotten the strap that you use on your sunglasses, the one that holds it on your head. So if you turn backwards, then your glasses don't go flying off.
Right.
I got a wide version of it. It's about 3/4 inch wide on the back side of it. And I noticed that it covers the temporal lobe and it covers the occipital lobe, which are parts of your skull. So I'm like, all right, well, I'm covering a portion of my skull because I noticed that the standard 218 doesn't say what portion or what percentage of your head it has to cover.
That's
so
correct.
I figured, okay, well, I got my temporal covered.
You could also ride with a beanie helmet on your knee and get away with it because it doesn't say you have to wear it on your head.
You know, I never thought about that. That's very true.
So I wore that, and I got a DOT sticker, and I glued it to the back of it, and I've been wearing that around every day. And I finally got snatched up after a month of riding with it. I finally got snatched up twice in one day.
Oh,
and each cop that gave me a ticket didn't stay long enough to see me put on a different type of a hard shell. they just said, do you have another one on you? I said, yeah, I do. I said, all right. So they got on their car and they took off. So I just got back on the road and kept riding the way I was. Now, I noticed on CVC 40610, there's three different parts. One of them has to be met in order for the cop to make it a non-correctable violation.
Right.
I always have a hard shell strapped to my sissy bar.
Okay.
And I noticed that when I looked up 40610, part three says something along the lines of the violator cannot or will not promptly correct the situation of the violation. Well, I have a helmet strapped to the back of my sissy bar. Therefore, I am able and I can comply to fix the violation right then and there on the spot. Well, they mark them down as non-correctable violations. And I noticed this little trend that they got, and I was like, okay, so I am able to fix the issue, but you're going to say that I'm not, and you're going to mark it down as a non-correctable violation. All right, that's fine. So I ended up filing some complaints. I went and I talked to the traffic sergeants at both at the Riverside Sheriff's and over at the Moreno Valley Police Department. And one thing I noticed is that the older sheriffs, the older police officers, they don't give a shit. They don't care if you do or don't ride a helmet. Or if you do or don't wear a helmet, they don't give a damn. They just figure they'll scrape you up off the ground later on. They got bigger and better things to worry about, and a helmet is the least of their worries. So
yeah, they
got to
check.
Older,
they got to check the bottles under the counter at the bar to make sure there's no fruit.
Yeah, they got bigger things to do, you know. So for the older generation of police officers, I give them more respect because they don't give a shit about the helmet. They say, you know, each one of them told me, I don't personally give a damn if you do or don't wear it. If you don't want to wear it, then don't wear it. It's your life, you deal with it your way. And that was awesome to me. But it's the younger guys, the rookies that are the pain in the asses. But
they're
one thing I was told,
themselves.
Yeah, but the one thing I was told by the gentleman up in Sacramento, he told me flat out, they're only assholes because they're being taught only so much. And then you
That's
have
it.
To look at the supervisor, and you have to question the supervisor, say, how well are you training these guys when they go out to the field? Because at
that's
first,
why
I was
you
pissed
ask,
at the rookies. Yeah.
That's why
first
you ask for the watch commander.
Rookies. Exactly.
Yep. That's
but
why you ask for the watch commander.
Here, yeah, but unfortunately out here, they don't send the watch commander, and I've tried to do it. And it's gotten to the point now where if I even take my hands off the handlebars, they'll draw a gun. And so I just leave my hands on the handlebars. I'm not allowed to put my kickstand down. So I can't even make a phone call to call the police department and call 911 and say, hey, I fear for my life. I need you guys to send a watch commander out here ASAP. Okay, well, what's going on? Well, I'm being pulled over by one of your cops. I fear for my life. I can't even do that because if I take my hands off the handlebars, I get a gun drawn on me. So I just kind of kept it the way it was. I just hold my recorder in my hand. I record it. And I had one law enforcement officer telling me, he's like, you know, you should have told me that you're recording. You're not allowed to do that. I can take you to jail right now. I said, the fuck you can. I said, obviously, you don't know shit about the recording laws. We're on a public street. You're a public official getting paid by public dollars. I can record whenever the fuck I want, as long as I'm not inside of a restaurant or an establishment that is considered private property.
Go ahead, Merlin.
Well, I was going to say, if you're a party to the conversation, you have absolute recording rights regardless of where it
exactly.
is or not.
Yeah.
The fact that it's
all
public,
you have to do is tell them you're turning it on.
Just boosts it.
You don't even have to tell them you're turning it on. As long as it's in a public area, you could just hold your recording in your hand or put it in your pocket and leave it there.
We used to do this all the time. You turn it on, you leave it, and especially if it's got a red LED that indicates recording, you just set it where he can see it, and it calls the meeting to order right now. What you might do, Doc, and I think you and I know each other. I was in Riverside County for half a dozen years in 2000, 2008, and 2009. Rode with Black Sheep at the time. But what you might want to do is get a copy of the federal injunction, the 1995 federal injunction out of San Diego, and start plastering that to Moreno, Riverside, both the sheriff and the local gendarmes. What this does is this sets the rules under a federal injunction as to what it takes for an officer to properly write a helmet ticket in the state of California. It's the only injunction of its kind. It's now 17 years old, and it
still in effect.
I'm sorry?
It's still in effect.
Very much so, and it sets the rules The officer has to have absolute knowledge of a number of things, including what your knowledge of those similar items and information, like is the helmet certification still valid? Has there been a recall? Do you know? Does he know you know? It's an absurd, in reality, it's an unworkable set of requirements, but that's what was legally ruled in order to properly write a helmet ticket in California from 1995. This was Bolt, Bianco. And get a hold of a copy of that thing and just start plastering it around. Because
here's the beauty of it that I've caught on to. There is no law whatsoever that states you cannot manufacture your own helmet. So
correct.
When I took that sunglass strap and put the DOT on the back, I was doing them a favor by putting DOT on the back because there's no law that says I can't modify my helmet any way I want.
Not only that, when you build your own helmet, you become the manufacturer.
Exactly.
And change your thinking from DOT to DOT. That's a DOT sticker. DOT would indicate Department of Transportation. DOT is specifically used by the Department of Transportation to not indicate Department of Transportation. The DOT sticker is a manufacturer's certification. A honest to God, stick it on the back of the hat, hold up the hat and say, my God, that's a good one, and stick this thing on, says, we think it's a good helmet. Doesn't say we tested it. Doesn't say we kept records of the test. Doesn't say it did or did not pass the test. But the only person, the only entity that can apply a DOT sticker to a helmet is the manufacturer. Therefore, if you've manufactured the helmet, not only is it legal for you to put the sticker on, it's basically demanded, especially if you're going to sell it. Like if you want to sell it to your brother, put the DOT sticker on because now he's the consumer and you've complied with the federal requirement to inform the consumer that, oh, this one's certified to DOT.
Exactly.
You're absolutely right. There's the specifications, the 218 gets really cheesy because it is not a testing standard, but it is a suggestion of tests that might be standardized.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had more than a few fun things over this, you know, how this works. Red Baron actually got a certificate from his mother as his manufacturer. She manufactured him. Therefore, she certified his head, his skull, as being certified to 218. And he used to walk into court with that certification from mom. And oh, God, it just got, you know, funny because the court is standing there with something that absolutely is in compliance with the law. And they won't do the correct thing, which is, oh, manufacturer's cert. See ya. But,
yeah, just to let you know, Merlin, he's being schooled by Mark.
That's what I was wondering, if this was one of the – he said Sacramento, and I'm going, okay. You know, we got Alcon Blanton, you know, who's in there. And so,
yeah,
so
no,
Mark,
I turned him on to this almost 2 years ago now.
In that case, Doc, you're in the hands of the gods. Mark is an amazing, amazing gentleman. I'm getting back into the fight. I didn't mean to, but I found myself becoming more and more interested in it as I travel around the country. And I'm getting back into it. It's really kind of dopey. But thanks, guys. You restarted my nefarious career as a rabble rouser and rebel, and I appreciate it.
Where are you at now, Merlin?
Right now, I am in Tennessee, a little bit north and east of Knoxville. I'm heading towards Nashville. Charlie Baker and I are going to meet up tomorrow evening, and then I'm working his event.
Merlin, are you my Facebook friend?
Is this Jan or
no? Lisa.
Lisa
Parsons.
Lisa's in Ohio, Merlin.
I don't think we've befriended on Facebook yet.
Did I ask your last name?
Bianco, B-I-A-N-C-O.
Oh, it's not you, it's another Merlin, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right. No, well, I don't mind it being another Merlin, but the other Bianco, he's my brother, so I got things to say about him.
Hey, you guys, I hate to break in, but I've got to get off here. I've got homework to do. I've got school all day tomorrow. I just want to thank Pete for inviting me on, and this was a great show. I'm glad I got this.
Yeah, and anytime you want to get in, just call.
Yeah, thank you so much for every, this is a great show, and I will definitely call back. And
okay, tell your friends.
Oh, I will definitely tell my friends.
Tell both of them.
Okey-dokey.
And good night, Pete, and good night, Merlin. Good night, Doc. Good night, Carrie.
Good night.
Good night, Phil. And I will talk to you guys on Thursday.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hey, you guys, hold on. Carrie, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Carrie, hold on a second. I was talking to Terry. He's in. You're in Chicago right now, or are you on your way to Louisville?
No, I'm still in Chicago. Won't be leaving here until Friday.
Okay. What do you think about what you're hearing?
Well, I think that it's life in the big city, man.
That's
it really
true.
Boils down to it.
That's true. A little birdie told me you were nervous about the pictures I posted.
The pictures that you posted? I saw the numbers, but no, not nervous at all. In fact, I was rather pleased. You know, that represents diversity, and that's what it's all about. You know, the world isn't about one kind; it's about all kinds.
Right. And the person that told me that, I was like, no, they called me. She's probably going to call you and let you know what we talked about. Because I told her to do that. It'd be easier for her to get a hold of you than me at different times of the day. This is what I need people to understand. We've got Kerry in Scotland, who's given us a different perspective on how life is in Scotland for bikers. We just had Lisa in Ohio giving us her perspective on how things happen in her neck of the woods, and your neck of the woods, Doc's neck of the woods. Doc's about 100 miles north of me. Merlin's in Tennessee. Merlin, have you had anything happen to you on the road? Have you been pulled over or anything?
Yeah, actually I did. I got pulled over about 4 or 5 days ago. I'm riding pretty straightforward looking 95 Dynaglide. I got a bunch of luggage and baggage on it. I live on the thing. And I'm wearing an obvious helmet. It's not a three-quarter, it's a half shell. But, just because I don't want to train everybody as I pass through their town. And young officer pulls me over, and I'm thinking, okay, you know, light out, no turn signal. And turn signals, mufflers, things like that, they're pretty damned optional here in the South. And he says he wanted to inspect my helmet. And I said, get a warrant. And he stopped, and he said, you can't talk to me like that. And I looked at him, and I said, son, I got T-shirts older than you are, and I know what my rights are. You want to inspect anything except my driver's license and the vehicle registration, get a warrant. And he said, well, I need to make sure if it's legal. And I said, no, you need to make sure if it's illegal, then come find me. And he stood there, and he thought about it for a minute, and I was tempted to say, just quit thinking about it and go away. And I just figured, no, let's just see what he does. And he walks to the back of the bike, and he has to bend down to see the CAL on the license plate. And he says, oh, California. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you're used to dealing with people differently. And I said, no, I'm used to being treated with some respect. And then if I've done something wrong, deal with me that way. You came out of the car looking for trouble, and I'm it. You wanted to come out and go for coffee, I'd go with you. Right now, I need to meet your uncle first. And he sat there, and he didn't quite know what to do with it, which is precisely what I was going for.
Huh?
And I said, either write the ticket without inspecting the helmet or looking for anything or knowing what you're looking for, but when you write the ticket, put down that you don't like the helmet.
You can't put down that I don't have one, because I do. You and I both agree that that's probably a helmet. And he said, well, I think I have to call this one in. And I said, oh, God, please do. Hang on a minute. And I pulled my phone out, and I said, I'll call in with you. What's the station phone number? I said, your radio might not work. And he just dropped it right there. He said, sir, he said, I'm just, have a good day. Have a nice day. And he turned around and rode off. Got into his car, and he sat there for the longest time. And while he was deciding what to do, I swung back on the bike, fired it up, rode off down the road and crossed the county line and said, forget it. But it, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, before I got a little more involved in the helmet law, in the fight, I would have handled it differently. But everything that I learned and everything that I knew and realized years ago, all of a sudden, it's the comfort zone I was in the last half dozen, 8, 10 years, it wasn't there anymore. This kid had been taught some stuff and then sent out on the street with bad information, a bad toolbox, and he was going for it. And I was his worst nightmare. And I loved it. And that's what I'm saying. I've gotten back into the fight, and I want to thank you guys for, you know, tickling, because I've been in touch with, Mark, among other people. And it's just, I thought it would have gone away. And now I see people down here in the South, and in North Carolina especially. I've been here, 8 weeks, running around the South. But in North Carolina, where the fight's big time, South Carolina, there's no helmet law. And
right.
But in North Carolina, it's a fight, and it's ugly. It's stupid for the law enforcement to have gone as far into anarchy. And I don't care what the law is, we're going to enforce the law. And I will see people with helmet stickers that say ride free, and I'm looking at it going, no, you need to put the helmet sticker on the inside of your windshield so you can see it. You want to ride free, fight that law. And
mm-hmm.
and it's kind of angered me up a bit. It's ticking me off, which is fine at this point. That's what keeps me going, because a little adrenaline keeps the heart from stopping. But that's the first problem of any legal kind I've had at all in a year on the road. And I just, kid walked into a running buzzsaw. It was cute, because he just, you know, I want to inspect the helmet. And the last thing he expected was get a warrant.
Right.
62-year-old bearded tourist, you know, get a warrant is not what he thought he was going to hear. But, hey, you want to play with the big boys, you get off the porch to do it. By God, bring your running shoes.
Right.
That's why I think maybe Doc and I knew each other, because he's what he's doing and how he's going at it. We probably bumped into each other there in Riverside somewhere.
Possibly. Well,
one event or another, at least.
Well, I tell you
we had
Philip is the one who lit the fire under my ass for fighting the helmet law, and then I was recommended to, or Mark Temple was recommended to me, and then from there it just really took off. My mind got open, and it wasn't just fighting the helmet law; it was figuring out your rights. Because in school they teach you the bare minimal, the bare bones. That is it. They teach you what you need, what they think you need to know, and that is all they're going to teach you. That's what they're going to teach kids in school nowadays. We're going to teach you what we want you to know. Other than that, we're not teaching you shit else. You know.
Yeah.
And
well,
and,
last week we played a thing about the Second Amendment, and Terry, do me a favor and tell these guys what you thought about what you heard about the Second Amendment.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Regardless of whether you are for guns or not, the fact of the matter is it's part of our constitution.
Well,
it's a right. So, you know, it's something that should be accessible and knowledgeable for all to participate in the freedoms in which we were granted. upon the founding of his country.
Well,
that's about it.
Thomas Jefferson said, and I'm trying to pull up the correct quote, but I can get pretty damn close to it, that a little revolution in the politic is as natural and necessary as a storm in the natural. And what he meant was, you got to clean out the crap every so often. And I was talking with a shrimp boat captain in Louisiana a couple of months ago, and she was telling me that as bad as the hurricanes are, they do come in and sweep out all the crap off the land. That's why that 20 miles of wetlands looks so clean. There are no junk cars out there because they've all been dragged back to sea. But you have to, they understood it because they were in the process of a shooting war to change the government. They had, a good portion of these people had come to this land in order to change the government that they were working under. And they understood the necessity of it. And they understood that a government that fears the people has freedom. A government that is feared by the people has tyranny. And they knew how to hold the difference, and the difference was in the firearm. And that's why it's the Second Amendment, not the 28th or the 15th or the 10th. They understood the value.
Sorry, can't hear. Steve Byrne, I just put a big name to Pete that's online. He's not feeling too well tonight. And I just put a big name and
I can see. I didn't understand a word, Carrie. I don't know what's going on, but
yeah, that was weird. I feel like you're talking to a fan.
Yeah, Carrie, my
yeah.
I had an ancestor in 1684. He fought at Bothwell Bridge against King Charlie II's takeover of the church, and he ended up in Edinburgh dungeons. And then they said, "You want to be a rebel rouser and a freedom religious freedom fighter? Then by God, we'll send you to the colonies." So his family ends up fighting against England in the Revolutionary War and 1812, and you know, we've been picking fights with governments ever since, just because now it's in our blood. That's where America was founded, was taking on the government. We've forgotten how to do that, and it's time.
And I agree with what you said about that. Definitely holding your government officials accountable for the decisions and things that they advocate is definitely something that we should all become engaged in. We've been sitting by for so long just being subjected to the whims of officials on a daily basis, to the extent that we've become overwhelmed by the detriment that they've caused by the decisions that they've
made.
Right.
I think one of my thoughts is, before you can put a new law in place, you have to take an old one out. I'd love to see that. The other thing is, ask a candidate. Next time somebody says, "And I'm going to be accountable," just stand up and ask the question of how. Because the election process does not hold you accountable to me. It holds you accountable to fundraisers. I want to know how you want to be accountable to the electorate. And there's no real answer to that, because there's no way for somebody to be accountable to you, the voter. It just almost doesn't exist in the system. But it's the byword, it's the buzzword.
Well, I think the public official is actually just a gateway to opportunities. Access to opportunity is what you have there with the public official. And since they do work for us, it does put it back on us to tell them what we'd like to see happen.
Agreed.
Say, for example, we're having issues in the community. If we can come up with those programmatic solutions to resolve those issues, it's the resources now that we need to put in place. And so now it's the responsibility of the public official to get those resources. So if we're detached from those public officials and detached from the issues, then we really don't have a complaint other than the fact that we're not involved. in our own communities to become a source of change. And so,
very true. Very true. And I was for 7 years I worked for the registrar, voters registrar in Riverside County, and I ran precincts, and then I was a district inspector, and it gets real interesting because I would hear people just go through the bitch and moan and snivel aspect of post-election discussions, and every time I'd sense it, I would ask, well, did you vote? Oh, you know, and if I got a negative answer, nah, I didn't want it, it doesn't make any difference, and I said, fine, you know, you want to talk football? Because your opinion doesn't count there either. And it's, you have to hold your neighbor accountable for his vote. Did you waste it or did you use it? Charles, Mayor Daley of Chicago, he had it right when he said vote early and vote often. You know, it's a little greedy, but he had it right. You've got to vote every time you get a chance. And that's how you make sure you get to the dance. It's like a helmet ticket. You can't get to court and go to the dance until you got the ticket. And that was, hell, we used to give Red Baron our tickets for his birthday. You know, we'd go out and get a ticket on his birthday just because that was, you know, we knew he'd enjoy that. Beer he just drank. But, yeah, it does get interesting because the we have one of the lowest democracies. We're actually a republic, but we have one of the lowest voting percentages, and it's the easiest place to vote. And kind of makes you ashamed of, you know, what we're doing as a group.
Well, I can certainly appreciate that, being African-American, having part of a demographic that is among one of the lowest to turn out during the elections, whether they be federal, state, or local. That's something that we've been working to change. We find that there's a lack of appreciation as to how things work because, for the most part, people don't know how things work in many urban communities. At one time, civics used to be taught in public schools. Well, that's been taken out. And so there's really not a good understanding of how the electoral process works within the urban demographic. That piece needs to be reinstituted in those schools so that folks can become engaged in, you know, conversations like this on a lateral basis to help people to appreciate that they need to get out and vote. And that's one of the things that we were involved in 2008 with that, when Right for Change, Right for Hope first started, was to encourage folks to register to vote. So I really appreciate what you're talking about there. And there really is a need to get people to understand the power that they have with the ballot alone. And then it goes on from there.
Because without the vote, and you know, you and I both know, everybody that's involved in this conversation tonight, whether you're just listening or you know, voicing your opinion, we all know there's things that are wrong that we need to see, we would like to see corrected. And we may disagree on how many of what first, but we know that there's things wrong. We also know that there's a lot of things right, and we want to boost and enhance those. But what I didn't realize until a few years ago when I started, I worked with a school system about 10 years ago, I went in to overhaul their computer systems and how they were handling the equipment, was there is no civics class. This is what you're mentioning. It's gone. And screwdriver, you were saying the same thing. They don't teach anything. And I began to wonder, well, is it done by osmosis? Is it like sex was in the 60s? We learned about it, you know, under a blanket with a flashlight. How does this work? And there's a much bigger motive to learn about sex than there is to learn about civics. So I'm sure that's part of how it works. But it's really a major failing, almost to the point where is this a conspiracy of a type to limit the education of the voter? If you don't teach them, you help them remain ignorant, therefore they become powerless. And I hate to start bringing up, you know, theory.
You're going to make me fall out of my chair with that comment.
You know, conspiracies, I hate to bring it up, but I'm curious. You know, it's just one of those things like, how come it takes 11 years to find a guy, and then when they really do pin him down, he's 1,000 yards from the Pakistani military academy, 40 yards from the Capitol, and a bunch of SEALs go in, and the SEALs are marvelous people, but they go in and they take care of business, and it's a 10 or 15 minute firefight, and it's done. And then they don't want to bring the body back and actually have DNA proof and everything else. They buried him at sea, is what I understand. We're going, okay, is...
They got the DNA from his sister. She died of cancer in Florida.
Well, you know how many years they kept waiting for Hitler to walk back into Berlin?
That's true, too.
Because nobody said, here it is. Here's the body. And it's just... one of those things where, oh, good, we got something else to play conspiracy games with. Was it really bin Laden? Because you can have DNA and say, oh, look, here's DNA. But if you can't absolutely convince everybody that that DNA came from that body, and here they both are, hey, the theorists are going to have a field day with this one. It just, you can see, I can see it coming, you know. The people
yeah.
that are, may now be convinced the birth certificate really is valid, they're going to go after this one. This is just. But I keep wondering, 11 years, come on, people. 10 years, what? How does this work? And
anybody want to comment on that?
Agreed.
Oh, I really did go far afield. Nobody's got to...
No, I, that's a one-word comment, agreed.
Oh, I'm sorry, Terry.
I agree also.
You know, it's no different than any other kind of propaganda. You put it out there, the people don't question it. They believe it. So,
well, Goebbels, who ran the propaganda ministry for the Third Reich, he had it very big. He said, tell a big lie and tell it often. They'll believe that. The little lie that you only put out there, that doesn't get believed. So tell the big lies and tell it often. And so, you know, propaganda is... we're good at it during World War II. We're good at it now. In fact, we're so good we don't even know how good we are. But
when tolerance becomes a wellness.
I'm sorry?
You know, do you guys know who Alan West is?
Yeah.
Okay. And he just came out with something this year. But it's entitled, I'm gonna pop this in. And I want to share this with everybody because it's really informative. But it's called A Man Must Stand for Something or Fall for Anything, since you guys brought up the propaganda issue.
Well,
this
no.
is a good one.
Well, no, hold
and
on.
I'm
going to
play this right now.
When tolerance becomes a one-way street, it leads to cultural suicide. And that's where we are. Because if we are not willing to stand up and call a certain wrong a wrong, if we are not willing... to stand up and identify and say everything.
Can everybody hear that okay?
I got it.
I'm good.
Okay.
In the years. Well, we have a national security strategy that talks more about global warming than it does about Islamic extremism, Muslim terrorism, Islamic terrorism. Well, we are now talking about overseas contingency operations and man-caused disasters. Something is wrong. We have become upside down. You know, we don't want to say that there is a group of individuals out there that are the antithesis of who we are, what we stand. But yet we want to continue to, you know, make our way of life subservient. We have a recalcitrance. We have a fear. Something that is keeping us, holding us back from saying that there is nothing wrong with standing upon the Judeo-Christian faith heritage that we find in the United States, that we find in Israel, we find all across Western civilization. We have got to recognize who the enemy is. Because my fear is that right now we are standing in some 1930s Sir Neville Chamberlain moment where we really do believe that we can compromise and negotiate and we can appease people who mean to kill you and harm you. And when I sit back and I hear so often everyone talks about, well, it's just the Taliban or it's just Al-Qaeda, I mean, it's such a narrow focus. That would be just the same as if, you know, the United States of America went to war and said, we're only going to go fight the second platoon of Charlie Company of the enemy. Nations have to understand and recognize what is it that is fueling the enemy that we are fighting ourselves against. What are their goals and objectives? See, before Al-Qaeda came along, the number one terrorist group that had killed more Americans was Hezbollah. And so we can't stop recognizing them. Or we can't recognize the fact that we are sending money into Gaza Strip, and Gaza Strip is controlled by a known terrorist organization, which is Hamas. You know, we made a very terrible mistake. You know, Shah of Iran may not have been the most perfect of gentlemen. But when we did not support the Shah of Iran, we allowed the Ayatollah Khomeini to take over power. What we did, we created the problems that we see right now. We created the resurgence of a radical Islamic totalitarianism, which is imperialistic in nature and its design. And we've got to understand that. We've got to understand that, true enough. We don't need to sit here and say it's every Muslim. But there is a core group of individuals that if we're not careful, they can easily destroy this country. I had an interview last week with a gentleman from the London Daily Telegraph, and he said, well, don't you think that you're giving them too much credit, you're giving them too much, you know, props or something like that? And I said, very simple. Let me talk to you about some numbers. 19 people killed 3,000 people on 9/11. One person killed 13 American soldiers and wounded another 30. One person, if it had not have been caught, could have killed countless amounts of individuals in Portland, Oregon at a Christmas celebration. See, those are the odds. And so I'm not going to discount the onesies or the twosies because those are truly the numbers that can still affect things. Look at what just recently happened in Iraq with the car bombing there. We don't need to talk about what happened in Netanya. We don't need to talk about what happens in Sedrup. And if I didn't pronounce that right, remember, I am from Georgia, so I do have this accent thing. But when I go there and I see the young children who are shell-shocked, when I see the playgrounds, they have bomb shelters next to it. Why? Why is that happening? And that story is not getting out. See, after you recognize the enemy, another thing that we need to do, we have to win this information operations war. Because when that whole Gaza flotilla tape came out, I was sitting there with my wife. I said, Angela, those guys have paintball guns strapped to their backs. No one really understood that. But they had to use their personal sidearms to defend themselves. We are giving the enemy every advantage, every opportunity that we can. Just the same as in Iraq and Afghanistan with our soldiers. The rules of engagement that we have created gives the enemy the initiative over our soldiers. So we have got to once again get out there and put our message out. Put our message out that says, we stand for freedom. Put our message out that says, it is not us who are killing just as many Muslims as are the terrorists. It is not us who are going into schools and decapitating headmasters. It is not us who are going up to girls' schools and throwing acid on young girls or gunning them down. It is not us who are shooting rockets and missiles from land that we continue to cede over in the hopes of peace. Ladies and gentlemen, the time is coming where we must all stand upon a conviction. Because as my mom said, a man must stand for something or else he'll fall for anything. And right now we're falling. We're falling to the point where what happens when that whole thing about mutually assured destruction theory goes out the window? That's what we operated with the Soviet Union, but that's not going to be a viable alternative solution if Iran gets a nuclear device. When Mahmoud Ahmadinejad goes into Lebanon, he faces toward Israel and says, we stand for the destruction of the Zionist state. What more do you need? What more evidence do you need? There comes a time when if someone continues to poke you in the chest, you must understand that you have to take that seriously. It reminds me of when Theo van Gogh, who was a Dutch filmmaker, saying, as he was being stabbed repeatedly to death to his assailant, can't we just talk about this? Now, I don't know about you, but when someone's driving a knife into my chest, I think the whole course of of action of less having a intellectual discourse is over. But yet, on a grander scale, that's what we're allowing to happen. You look all across Europe, the anti-Semitism that is happening there. You look at what's going on in London. There's a YouTube video where we see rioting Islamists chasing away the British police. Malmo, Sweden, what was once a thriving Jewish community there, I believe has dwindled down to about 500. People are afraid to walk around with their yarmulkes. People are afraid to walk around and profess their Jewish faith in Europe. This is where we are in our country. And if you go back and you study history for the Jewish people, you were driven out of your homeland. You were driven off the Arabian Peninsula. You were driven because of the horrors of the Inquisition out of Spain. You were driven out of Eastern Europe. You withstood the Holocaust. We finally said that we would return the Jewish people back to their homeland. And immediately after May of 1948, you were attacked. When does the time come when we say enough is enough?
What do you think about that?
I love the comment about the Neville Chamberlain moment. Do you understand who Neville Chamberlain was? This is the Prime Minister of England who in 1938 came back from a meeting with Hitler where they gave Germany Czechoslovakia, and he waved a piece of paper and said, I have peace in our time. They had compromised and rolled over to buy peace from a man who had no problem in going to war. He just was waiting for his military and timing. And that's, in my mind, that's an extremely astute comparison to what's going on. And I that one caught me big time. That, yeah, we're not putting our message out. We're trying to buy the smooth way through the rapids, and that's not what's got to happen. Freedom has never been free, and to hang on to it sometimes is harder than to acquire it. But yeah, it's just.
Derek?
Well, you have to forgive me. I did have to take a call from one of our directors once the recording started, but I did hear him talk about standing for something and not falling for anything. So I can't agree with that. Not everything that you hear is true. And the things that you see, you know, sometimes you must question these things, the validity of them. So, yeah, I don't have a problem with that. I agree with that.
How about you, Pete? I think Pete's there, but I think we lost him. Yeah, it's like a snowball rolling downhill. Once it gets going, it's hard to stop.
Yeah, but I was reading a book here about a couple of guys that took on an absolutely you will literally get yourself killed kind of a project. And at one point, the guy gets into a real tough situation, and it's a true story. And he thinks his way out of it using a snowball analogy, in that if you take care of the little problem when it first pops up, it cannot become the snowball. And that's how he literally keeps himself alive in this situation that was killing other people. And he's right. You got to handle the little ones, and that's where the difference between leadership and a reactive government, which is what we appear to have now, is. Roosevelt, Franklin Delano, Roosevelt, he was a leader. He was proactive. He was trying to get ahead of the curve, and knew what he wanted America to be, and, you know, he did not agree with Chamberlain or compromise or, you know, let's just give away somebody else because that way we can be safe behind our brick walls and bars on our windows. The problem with being barred in to protect yourself from the outside is you're the one that's barred in. And we do have a problem. We are out there in the world, and we're sending young men and women out to fight and die. And I was talking with an Afghan vet the other day, and I said, my God, and I was apologizing to him. And he looked at me and said, why? And I said, because when we were doing Vietnam, at least we had an idea that we were trying to win and what we were fighting against. You guys are out there trying to figure out who, and they don't even want to try to tell you what. And it was interesting because the politics of the Vietnam War and the discussions were huge and immense. And it's almost un-American to argue the right or wrong of being there. It's been turned into, oh, if you think we're wrong to be there, you must want our soldiers to die. And that's not it at all. I want everybody to live happy. And that's why I think we're wrong in doing some of the things we do. God. Sorry, gentlemen.
No.
Didn't mean to wander off into left field there again.
No, and I got something I want you guys to hear, man. I think this is appropriate right now. That's a guy who stood up in front of about 5,000 people and did that. As he started singing, everybody stood up. It's just like a domino effect. Everybody stood up. I put that up in the chat room if you guys want to go check it out.
Yeah, and it's almost universal now to get to the end of that tune and imagine the words "play ball." You know, it was a drinking tune before Francis Scott Key wrote down the poems. And what he sang is the missing thirds. Nobody knows the third stanza. God. Todd.
You learn something new every day.
America is so cool. You know, it really is an amazing place. You know, I bump into people that haven't got a clue what happened in the history of their little town, and then you'll bump into some guy that opens up the back room of his house and shows you a 40,000 book library, and the town schools borrow books from him. And he does willingly, you know, and it's just, I've been out almost a year now and riding around, and it just, God, it just continues to amaze me. I keep waiting to get tired of it, and I can't. I do want to plug the Feed America at biker rally in Nashville this weekend at the.
Yeah, I should see you there, hopefully.
Yeah. Oh, really? You coming out? Cool.
I'm going to be one of the celebrity guest chefs.
Sweet. Because I got told I was a special guest, and I asked if that meant I came in on the small bus.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to working the whole weekend. It's one of the things where that's something I can do, and I look forward to seeing you.
Okay. As of right now, I should be leaving here Thursday evening.
Well, leave Thursday.
Terry, Terry, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I just pulled up your email about Louisville. You want to give yourself a plug?
Well, sure, certainly. Thank you. Thank you so much. This Saturday, we're going to have our first event this year outside of our launch event in Louisville, Kentucky. It will be the Ride for Change, Ride for Hope. And this year's theme is Keep It Moving. So we're keeping it moving from city to city, spreading the message regarding the Ride for Change, Ride for Hope and its mission to connect with local not-for-profit organizations that are addressing the needs of at-risk youth, especially those that have an emphasis on education. We will be culminating at the Muhammad Ali Museum for a presentation, and we'll be making a special announcement there regarding a new component to the Ride for Change, Ride for Hope. I'd like to tell you now, but I can't because it would be a surprise on Saturday.
Well, when you want to get in on that, or you want to call next Tuesday and give everybody an update on what you just said,
we'll
no problems. Anytime, man. This is open to everybody. Anybody's got a burning desire, anything they want to talk about, go for it.
We're looking to spread this Ride for Change, Ride for Hope project around the country and engage motorcycle clubs and independent riders. But the diversity of clubs, not just one ethnic group or one type of motorcycle club or even type of bike. Based on what we've been able to discern, there's 12 different types of motorcycle clubs out there. And we're looking for leadership in each of these areas to become engaged in our project and bringing forward the occasion in the local communities around the country. And in this way, we're able to have folks to work together that would not ordinarily work together, taking the motorcycle community to places they would not ordinarily go together, and
mm-hmm.
accomplishing community goals in a manner that they would not ordinarily embark upon. So it's a great
right.
opportunity. It's a great opportunity. You know, we don't communicate often, and this affords us the opportunity to get together and have conversations about issues that matter. And
what I'll do right now is I'll let you know that Thursday, if you call in, you can talk to Bill. I've already told him about what's going on. I've showed him the site. And he's interested to hear what you have to say. And maybe we can, between me, you, and Merlin, we can smooth Bill into starting something out here because we have a few clubs down in San Diego that we deal with on a daily basis.
Ah, yes.
There's a few.
Took the words out of my mouth. I don't have to ask you. You're telling me.
Harry, tell me a little about it. It's called RIGHT, R-I-G-H-T, for Hope, Ride for Change.
No, it's Ride, Ride for
Ride.
Change, Ride for Hope. You know, there's an old expression in the neighborhood, this is how we roll, or this is how we do it.
Yeah.
Well, we contend in order for us to see some some real change in our communities. We've got to change how we roll. Change how we roll. And then that way we create opportunities for hope. So, you know, we got to leave this place a little bit better than how we found it.
Now,
and what I did, Terry, was I put that thing about Louisville. I put the link up there. I put your name, the world of Soul Motorcycle Community, the Ride for Change, Ride for Hope. And I put the last sentence you just said about Ride for Change, Ride for Hope is an awareness campaign that culminates with the motorcycle event in local communities across the nation.
Right.
Yeah, I just pulled up your website, Terry, and 2010 Journey gives attention to our heritage and calls for social reconciliation.
Yes.
I would like to congratulate you on the concept and the wording on that one.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Yes, while encouraging a connection between youth and adults, my God, I'm impressed here. I hate to join anything because if I join something, that means their standards are low. But I will allow you to draft me. This is cool. I'm looking forward to learning more for here. And is that you? Is that your picture here on the face? Right on the front page is a red, white, and blue Ride for Change, Ride for Hope. And then there's a picture of a what looks like to be a smart, articulate man next to
him. Oh, yeah. You're looking at the main page. I'm thinking, question marks over my head. What is he talking about? Yeah, that is me. That's me.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's me, sure is.
Now you fall for flattery too, don't you? Terry, I would like you to understand one thing. I grew up in a house full of smart mouths and long reach over the dinner table, and I can do both. But I only tease the people that I know are smart enough to deal with it, and the people that I can like and respect or love and respect. And so, please, if I ever say anything that you find offensive, just slap me. I'll get the hint. But I don't
say
mean,
whatever you like.
I do not mean to ever be offensive, but it's
not necessary. It's an opportunity to get to know each other.
So I'm looking forward to this. This is cool. I'm looking forward to this, and I'm gonna have to go through your website and see what I can do, and then I'll. See what I can do because I am out and about, and I'm starting to find the need for focus. The first year, I think I just wandered. Now I'm starting to find the need for focus, and there's a couple of things. Helmet Law is one of them. It looks like this might be the other one.
Well, the Ride for Change, Ride for Hope is a great opportunity because, you know, we've got some really interesting issues in our nation, in our world these days. It's really bad, and it really well comes down to, you know, this is either the end of the world or the start of a new beginning. So it's going to take all of us to bring about some type of sustainable solutions to issues plaguing our communities, not just some of us. I mean, when we think about the issue of education, we got it bad in this country, and we've got to turn this thing around.
Yeah.
To make our country more competitive in the global marketplace because the game has changed in a big way.
It has.
That's true. I received something today. Let me see if I can locate it here real quick. But I wonder if you guys knew this. Diane Sawyer is going to do a special report. It's coming up this week. But what they did was they removed all the items from a typical middle-class family's home that were not made in the USA. There was hardly anything left besides the kitchen sink, literally. During the special, they are going to show truckloads of items USA-made being brought in to replace everything, and we'll be talking about how to find these items and the difference in price, etc. But Diane Sawyer said, if every American in the United States just spent $64 more than normal on a USA-made items in this year, it would create something like 200,000 new jobs. Diane Sawyer walked into Walmart and was buying food. And it came up to where almost everything she picked up that was lower cost was made in China. If people don't know it, but Walmart's Our Family brand
Everything with that associated with that is made in China.
Right. And so here they are, Walmart. This is the biggest. This is the biggest put a paper bag over their heads move that the country has ever made as it relates to commerce. We've got these distribution centers. That's what they really are, all over the country. And it really changes how
they also have, if you walked in there and you just simply picked up a can and you just looked, turned it over and you saw made in China or PRC. PRC is the definition for Hong Kong.
Is that how we pay our debt down to China?
No, that's how it works. That's how it works up to China. Because the more we buy that isn't offset by the more by the numbers we export, that's how.
Well, think about
this.
Think about this. If 200 million Americans refuse to buy just $20 each of Chinese goods, that's a $1 billion trade imbalance resolved in our favor fast.
There it is. People go back to cheeseburgers. If everybody bought a cheeseburger instead of a frozen dinner. I don't know. One of the things that I've always enjoyed about Harley-Davidson's is when somebody comes up and says, yeah, an American bike, and then I will proceed to go through and explain that, yeah, the big plastic parts are made in Tonawanda, Wisconsin, but, and then the suspension, the carburation, the ignition, the seats, Pakistan, Japan, China, Germany. I mean, it's international commerce. But mostly it is perception, and that gets back to education. If you teach people what this is instead of what you think it is, a lot of people will, they'll, once they understand it's not what they think it is, then they do react and they will work it. So information. Worst thing you can do is teach a biker his rights, because now he's a rebel on a bike instead of just being some guy that thinks he ought to be free.
That's right.
This is cool.
You know, there's another thing I got today, and it says enlightened versus opportunistic. This is a tale of two cities and how they approach their traffic safety responsibilities. As the news title initiates, Roseville, California, and Chevy Chase Village in Maryland represent a contrast of law enforcement philosophies. Let's start with Roseville. Former Sacramento City Manager Ray Kerridge moved into the same role with Roseville a year ago. More recently, the city hired Police Chief Daniel Hahn, who also served in Sacramento. Together, Kerridge and Hahn have established a single new objective for the police force, reduce accidents. The emphasis is no longer on writing a certain number of tickets each shift. The Roseville police are making similar number of traffic stops, post Kerridge and Hahn, but the officers are now encouraged to give out more warnings than tickets. The assumption is that the warnings have the same safety impact as tickets for the stop motorists as well as passersby. It is working. The city averaged 209 citations per month over a recent 5-month stretch. The monthly average in the preceding 2 years was 1,253 tickets. At the same time, the number of traffic accidents dropped from 137 to 127 per month. It is allowed to work because revenue is not a major factor. Roseville retains less than 15% of each $233 speeding ticket, with the rest of money going to the state of California. It is comforting to know that Roseville is making fewer contributions to the state coffers under Kerridge and Hahn. Chevy Chase Village is opportunistic. Actually, greedy might be a better description. The village of 2,000 residents grosses $3 million per year from its speed cameras. That volume was no doubt enhanced by the fact that Chevy Chase Village borders on the northern outskirts of Washington, D.C. Location, location, location. The annual operating budget for the entire village is $4.5 million. Maryland state law does not require that speed camera revenue be spent on public safety programs. It's just a bit vague on what it constitutes. Even if small localities like Chevy Chase Village are conscientious about applying the money collected from photo tickets to safety projects,
The inefficiency of such programs can be staggering. A neighboring city administrator estimates his overhead cost to manage their speed camera program is more than one-third of collected revenue. The camera companies are smiling all the way to the bank.
Yep. Yep. It's an amazing number there in Roseville, how the accidents dropped by, 8%?
Right.
And the other number, that less than a third of that Class B revenue stays in the community, that I knew about and I understood, and it occurs to me that that is something that most people, including the city governments, very often don't understand, that
nope.
Just because you get the $270 doesn't mean you keep or use the $270. And that may be a way to kind of shift the playing field around a little bit. Because every time you send a cop into court, and we've actually used this as a tactic in the helmet law fight, we actually stacked the court with Oceanside PD 1 week. And literally drained about 40% of the officers off the streets and into the courts of San Marcos 1 week, and it's hugely expensive. And that was how we started to back away some of the enforcement. We just made it so damn expensive to write the ticket. And Roseville seems to have understood this, that you have an officer out there. If he's doing paperwork or sitting in court, he's not out there. He's doing
right.
And he needs to be out where he's visible, where he is of assistance or of education, a warning. And if it's really bad, no problem. We can write the ticket, too.
Yeah, or checking bottles at the bar for fruit flies.
Now, are these the blue fruit flies or the green ones? Because, there's a difference.
I know.
The thing is, none of us are surprised by it, right?
Exactly.
God. Yeah, you're kidding me, right?
I'm serious. I stood there and watched three of them do it, and when I asked the guy what was going on, he told me that the sergeant told him to get it done before the shift really took off.
Yeah, and that's what I'm telling you, is that none of us are surprised by it.
Nope. Even when I talked to the bartender and told her how long they've been trying to close the bar, she didn't get it until they gave her the ticket.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, does a police officer know the difference between a good fly and a bad fly, like a health department official? Seems to me that would be
helpful. Well, they were trained. They said ABC doesn't have enough people, so they're allowed to do it.
Damn.
Yep.
Well, my God. Better living through chemistry. Good can of Raid, and she'd have saved herself a ticket, wouldn't she?
Yeah.
It's stupid, because Oceanside is not known for its low crime rate, and yet
no.
they've got time to go out and do this kind of crap.
Well, they just arrested 35 people for running a prostitution ring with runaways.
Do you know how long you have to know about it in order to tangle up 35 people in the arrest?
Yeah, it took them over a little over 9 months.
Yeah. During those 9 months, how many illegal acts were performed while the police watched?
Exactly.
Now, and then you have to ask the other question that gets down to the root of why are we prosecuting prostitution. I'm sorry, where's the victim? I keep thinking that you shouldn't have a crime until you have a victim. But then
right.
I'm of the opinion you can't have a riot till the police get there anyway. So, you think about it. You ever seen a riot where there isn't police? No. Even at the soccer game, the cops are there. That's how you get a riot. You have to have police to have one. They're the only trained people for it. Everybody else is an amateur.
Absolutely.
Hey, how are some of your helmet tickets going there in Oceanside? Last time you and I talked was months and months ago on this one. Is it? Are you still further in your education there?
Yeah, the last one I had seven of them standing to my right saying they weren't how do you want to say, prepared. And I told the judge, well, here's all the paperwork for the last the last 3 months that I've been going with the city attorney back and forth. And, Your Honor, I mean, this is dragging out now. They want to get another continuance. Can we settle this today?
Ask for a dismissal with prejudice.
I did. I got it. I also got the writ to get back my gun, my knife, my hammer, and my helmet.
Oh, that's great.
Yep.
That's great.
Yep. I left there at 4:30, and they closed at 5. And when I got there, the guy told me I'd have to come back next week. So I called the lieutenant, and he told the guy, no, give the guy his stuff, and we'll call it a day.
Yeah.
When I go down around or anywhere, I just get waved at, or they look the other way.
Yeah, you have achieved the status of, unless he's pulling out of the Circle K with TV on the bumper, leave him alone, which is all you really wanted in the first place, right? But the ruling dismissal with prejudice means that if anybody touches you on this thing again, you got the big hammer in your hands. It's gorgeous.
That's correct.
That's gorgeous.
Correct.
I'm so...
Now they go down and they talk to Bill at the shop.
Right.
They don't even bother him no more. They just, if they want to talk to him, they just go down to the shop and lean on the counter.
Good. Good. Because that's all Bill ever wanted, was be treated like with a little respect. An anchor in the Oceanside business community, and I mean by that somebody strong to build a foundation on, not the thing you throw off the edge of the book, off the boat that sinks fast. Well, I don't know. He'd probably make a good boat anchor too. But as a businessman, for them to walk into his shop or to screw with him in any way is an absurd, counterproductive thing. And I know they were doing it. They've been doing it for decades.
Well, you know, when the mayor got elected, Bill called him to go have a sit down with him.
Yeah.
Well, he went to the shop to see Bill, and he told him, Bill, you don't recognize me? And Bill said, no, not offhand, you know. And he goes, well, I used to be the chief of detectives for the last 20 years, and we finally figured out you weren't so smart. But they were parked across the street, or they were up in the.
Yeah.
They were up in that storage place with the cameras rolling every day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeez. Well, it, I don't know. That's the fun thing about paranoia. When Steve and I were so deep in the fight in the early 90s, the Attorney General's office and the Highway Patrol, they were going nuts because they kept trying to get a hold of the HLDL and the Bolt membership list. And,
mm-hmm.
and they were convinced that, you know, there has to be a list. There has to be an organization.
Right.
And hell no. The only thing we had was a phone number of a whole bunch of fax machines all over California. And
we
thought handling a secret was, I got a secret piece of information. Hand me the fax machine and we dump it out. But there was never a list. But these guys wouldn't stop. They actually, Steve and I were absolutely convinced. And he's a tough one to convince on this kind of crap. But we were absolutely convinced phones were tapped. 92 to 94, and you know, we started playing with it, and so every
time they're still here listening right now.
You know, and it's you know, but the, at one point, in one deposition, one of the Highway Patrol attorneys asked for a membership list, at which point he was told of what. Prove
right.
the organization exists, and then maybe you might ask for a list, but there is none, and that's
right.
where the discussion stopped. And
they were the ones that put out that propaganda that it was all you guys were all a bunch of tweakers sitting up all night talking on the phone.
Yeah, but on the other hand, they're also the same ones that thought goddamn Bianco was all one word, and who the hell is this truck driver and pharmacy clerk in San Diego, and the things they said about Alcon and you know, Blancet, geez, you know, because they didn't know how to deal with people who were just trying to do it by the law. And that's what that was where it has to go right. When you walk into court and you're the only one doing it for the reasons under law, and you're the only one there who isn't being paid to be there, you're at a disadvantage. And,
that's correct.
I mean, I know. Guys lost their wives, their houses, and all kinds of shit over this fight.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I did a rough count of how much money it cost me one time. My God, I could live well right now. But I knew what I was doing, and I knew why I was doing it. And anybody who tries to do the right thing at the right time, whether it turns out to be a mistake or not, and it wasn't, but there's sometimes that people will try real hard to do the right thing, and then it turns out, gee, maybe that wasn't the right thing.
Yeah, I'm in for about 18 grand right now.
Yeah, you have to honor that effort. And, you know, very few people will risk everything for what they believe to be a lie.
That's
true. In
fact,
damn near nobody.
That's true.
And, no, I'm when a couple of months ago when Jan from NC Bolt, we first started talking on the show here, and she said, "My God, you're an icon." And I went, "No, it's just me." It surprised me. It amazed me that, one, somebody remembered, and two, that the damn thing was still going on, and it was still in the same billiards pocket that it was when I kind of burned out half dozen years ago and stepped aside and went to do something else for a while. And
it's like now when I talk to Red, you know what Red says?
Nah.
It sounds like you're preaching to the choir, Phil.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and we've had a couple of those discussions where we would sit there and we'd get more and more fired up and then realize that the other people we were trying to get fired up, they walked off. I don't know. It was an amazing time. And in talking with Jan and like I say, I've talked with Mark Temple a couple of times in the last month. It's still an amazing time. And, you know, I kind of wish I had the energy and the resources that I had 15 years ago, but I don't. But I do have some energy and I do have some resources, and I find myself redirecting them back into this freedom fight. And whether it's the helmet, you know, whether it's the helmet or just, you know, a bad cop who thinks he can handcuff Tiger Lily because he, you know, that's the bad training he got.
So right. They still think it's 1974.
Know. Yeah. You know, it's, and I'm sorry, gentlemen, you know,
Terry, what he's talking about, if you looked it up on the web, there's a site on there, it's called Bolt of California, or another site that's called Helmet Law Defense League, and you can see what these guys have done over the years.
Bolt of California. Okay.
Bolt of California. It's B-O-L-T,
just like a... what it stands for is Bikers of Lesser Tolerance.
Correct.
I will accept no discrimination before its time was kind of the offshoot motto. Tony Pan Sanfilippo was the he brought basically I think he brought it in from Wisconsin, but my brother Steve and immediately, you know, it may have been all one, you know, one flick of time, but God, we held a nationwide conference at a recording studio in L.A. in 93, I think it was, and Red Hot Chili Peppers donated a full weekend of studio time they paid for so we could hold the conference in that studio, and then they paid for both lunches, Saturday and Sunday lunches, for 40 people, just said, oh, it's the right thing to do. A couple of them were riders, but later on I'd find out or I'd get an estimation of what a weekend of studio time cost, and these guys had donated big time. But I look at the picture from that meeting, and you talk about a batch of heavy hitters. God, there's some smart people in that room. There was some amazing people in that conference. And, you know, it's we burned a stack of helmets in Sacramento, 94, 95, And opening day of the legislature, we went up to, you know, make our point again, and about 5,000 riders showed up, and we burned a stack of helmets right there on the sidewalk out in front of the Capitol. And the San Jose Mercury News compared us to the Indians throwing the tea in the Boston Harbor. And I sat there and I thought about that, and then I learned more about the men who had dressed up as Indians that night in Boston. And other than it really sounds like puffery when I think, you know, my God, I might be like these guys, they were simple people who had been pushed to an exorbitant act. You know, these were the same kind of guys that you and I work with and ride with,
right,
and argue politics. They just had been pushed to a point where you have to do something absolutely absurd to get the attention. And what amazed me was this fire right there on the sidewalk in front of the Capitol steps. There's five TV stations covering this thing, and not a moment of TV time on the act itself. The San Jose News, Mercury was there. They had a writer or two, and that was it. And it just, that always amazed me that you could do something like that. And, oh, did you know that according to the State House security that day, we were much better than the whale or the baby people because we didn't make a mess. And I always felt real good about that the people that were the real messy radicals, the ones that were really doing some damage to where they laid their protest, where one side, and I don't recall which side, of the pro or con abortion birthrights, and the whales, Save the Whale people. These were the ones that they worried about because they would make a mess and there would be bodily fluids and the AIDS thing was big and we don't know if it's whale blood or human blood and all you guys did was had a little fire on the sidewalk, you know. I'm going, that was 40 helmets.
Right.
But I did apologize to the guy who was pressure washing the sidewalk afterwards. And I said, you know, I'm sorry about that. You have to clean up our mess. And he says, hey, I don't care. I'm on time and a half. So, you know, kind of balanced out.
Right. Hey, I want to let you guys know we're running over, and it's being recorded, but it's not being streamed. So I offer Thursday to both you guys to return. Bill will be here, and we'll tear this thing open Thursday.
Yeah, you guys got me kind of stumped here. I'm thinking about this social reconciliation, cultural reconciliation piece that what is your name again?
My name is Merlin Bianco, B-I-A-N-C-O.
Is it Roland?
Merlin.
No,
Mike
Merlin.
Merlin Bianco. Very good, Merlin. Sorry about that. Terry Hardy. Terrible with names. I'll be writing those names down from here on out.
That's all right. As long as you spell it somewhere close to that on the check, I'm good.
Yeah, I know that.
And I rarely respond in late for dinner.
Yeah. What's the possibility of us connecting? Is there a number I can reach you at?
It's actually very good. I'll give you everything right now. My email is Merlin Bianco, MERLINBIANCO 1, the digit 1, all one word, at Juno, JUNO.com.
Great.
And I don't know. I don't know whether I want to dump the phone over what may become a national dump. Terry, email me, and I'll give you everything. It's actually the email and the phone. The rest of it is, I am wherever I am. I really don't have an address. Wherever home is, wherever the kickstand goes down. But
Terry, what Merlin's talking about is Merlin just decided one day to get on his bike and see the country.
Yeah.
And he hasn't stopped yet.
Is that right? How long was it? I thought it was 11 months earlier, for over a year now?
It'll be a year this weekend.
Man.
So the Nashville Biker Beach Bingo Party to Feed America, I've decided that's the Sunday in May, the Sunday in May that I left last year.
Well, I've been thinking about selling all my earthly possessions and hitting the road, too.
Yeah, see, the key is to have a real head start. Like, your business goes under because nobody has money to pay you to fix their old Porsches or old motorcycles, and then lose your house. See, that eliminates that big agony of, well, you know, now what do I do? And then it's a matter of just selling off the little stuff, like the library and the trucks, and yeah. But sooner or later,
is that what happened?
If you're lucky, yeah.
Okay.
And I was sitting in one of my ex-wife's garages, looking at the side of my motorcycle, and on the motorcycle I had a couple of stickers. One says old school, which I am, and the other says screw it, let's ride. So I did. Sold the truck. The truck was the tall pole. That's what set up when I left, and I have gone back to the coast a couple of times. I'm out of San Francisco and San Diego, and that's where I know Bill and Phil from, you know, I know Bill from the 60s. But I went back to California in mid-June for the birth of my granddaughter. And the little girl waited till all the grandparents were in the room. I thought that was damn considerate of her. Either she really likes grandparents or she needs an audience worse than anybody we'll ever meet. And then I was back for the holidays. Spent some Christmas time with her and with some of my friends. And then I stayed for funerals for four friends who died over the December and January. I have been traveling 30 states, 34,000 miles now. I have some idea where most of the money came from, but a lot of it I'm going, huh, how have I been doing this on that little? But a lot of friends and a lot of strangers have helped in an amazing collection of ways. I now have, when I send out an email going, okay, here's the report from the road or bike woe be gone, Garrison Keillor type, if I can. Scotland, Germany, Ecuador, Canada, and 20-some states in America. And these are all people I've, you know, other than a few, these are all people I've met on the road.
And just being on the show, we've hooked them up with what, about 10 people already that have opened their homes.
Yeah, you have, including Charlie Baker, who Nashville musician of note, and I'm looking real forward to him. I'm going to go in tomorrow and work setting up the event, and then work the event, and he said I could either. If I was really addicted to camping, sure, I can use the lawn, but he says, I got a good couch. You're welcome to that. And that's marvelous. And then, Terry, I'm listening to you speak, and I'm intrigued to meet you, too, because
you're going to be in Louisville this weekend, right?
Yeah, that's right, starting a Friday afternoon.
Yeah, I'm booked into Nashville big time, so I'm not going anywhere. I promised to work this event, and I'm looking forward to it.
Now, when you say you booked, are you a musician also?
No, but what I've done is I have promised to work it any way, okay. Anyhow I can.
Gotcha. All right.
And so it's a personal commitment. I've played till my feet. My fingers blistered on bass a couple of times, and I've, been able to not embarrass myself on a saxophone over the years, but it's been a long time, so I'm far from a musician. But I'm looking forward to, I like events and runs, and I really like working them and putting them on. In fact, I probably enjoy that more than I do going and participating on, somebody's run.
Have you found that... that runs themselves in this economy of kind of worn thin on a lot of folks, and participation may be down in comparison to previous years, and people may be questioning, you know, whether these are legitimate causes in the first place.
Making
it more difficult to put on those types of events.
Yeah, that's a valid question, but I don't think I've bumped into that. Is this a legitimate run event charity? But very definitely bumped into, I got someplace else to put the 20, 25, 40 bucks and the fuel. You know, I've watched my fuel cost go from $2.90 a gallon to $3.90 a gallon in less than a year. And when that's your major expense, boy, you keep track of that one. So where earlier in the year I'd run a couple of tanks through in a daytime nothing I like better than riding the bike. It's just everybody's got a golf game, and that's mine. I'll get to an event or something, and I don't do a whole lot of them just because a lot of times I don't know which day of the week it is. I just don't. It's not overly important to me. And
he's not kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. There's days when I don't know. I know that the month ends in 11, like May of 11 or, you know, February of 11. But other than that, I don't know the date, or I very, you know, a lot of times I'll have to pull the cell phone out and read it to see what day of the week and what date it is, because I just don't know. But I do know that people are, A, watching their money. The fuel thing has just choked people off big time all over. And, you know, by the time the President of the United States says something about it, it's like printed media. It's already obsolete information. And he's way behind the curve on that one. I haven't run across somebody where they're going, well, I don't know if this is right or not. I was out in the Outer Banks off North Carolina, Kitty Hawk and the Ocracoke Islands out there. And I went out for my own, oh boy, I'll go out there and take a look. It's been 40 years. And so I went out there, and I bumped into the last couple of days of Bike Week. I didn't know there was a Bike Week, an Outer Banks Bike Week, but it's actually a pretty good deal, and it's not organized like races or, you know, a big downtown section like Sturgis has, or races like Daytona and Sturgis has, or Laconia, and it's certainly nothing like Laughlin. It's 9 miles of outer islands that there's just all kinds of people on bikes and all kinds of people trying to, you know, entertain them or kick off their tourist season with them. And it's 9 years in the process now. It's the ninth year. And I would talk to locals, and they're going, no, this is a pretty good year. This is actually pretty good. And it's like this run this weekend out of Nashville. That's a 200-mile ride they've got planned. I don't know of any run in California that does a 200-mile ride.
No, maybe 100, 125, that's it.
And I'm curious to see just how many people, you know, pop for the 200 miles.
I mean, some of the parties that I go to, I ride 200 miles just to go to the party.
Yeah. And I, you know, you ride 400, 500, 600 miles to a party, and but to actually get there and then they have a 200-mile ride organized, that's pretty mandingo about it, the whole thing. That's big. And I was, you know, kind of impressed with that. And I've been impressed the way a lot of the southern riders, they'll, when they do pull the bikes out, boy, they want to ride. And they'll slam down some miles on an event. It's skinny, and I think it's almost exclusively the cost of fuel.
Right.
And that one's going to hurt a lot of things for a long time.
Well, we got to get some sponsors.
Yeah. I suggest BP.
Write them a letter.
That's a good suggestion.
They seem to have all the money.
See what they say.
Well, they are looking for ways to improve their image.
Exactly.
You know, although they're actually thought of halfway decent down along the Louisiana coast. They have worked hard to make sure it's not a problem. They've put
money out.
They're
also going to pay that big money here pretty soon. That's why they raised the prices.
Yeah, and, you know, and then you get, let me get this straight. You guys produced a quarterly profit of $10 billion and a $3 billion tax subsidy, and you did it on my dollar a gallon. Is that how it works?
Yeah, we're in the wrong business.
I've been in the wrong business all my life, you know, even when I was in, God, I was
in aerospace.
Yeah, but
you're doing what you love right now, and you were talking about how you love to put on motorcycle events.
Yeah, it's really funny. I really, really enjoy putting on events like that.
What do you like about it most? I mean, what makes it enjoyable for you, other than the fact that you like to ride a motorcycle?
Well, the motorcycle is one thing. Me and the bike, that's a, God, it's, well, it's almost a personal relationship. It's there's something perverted in there somewhere. But what I enjoy about the events is dealing with a variety of people. I am an engineer by nature and by trade, so problem solving is a kick in the butt for me. It's a hook. And the kinds of problems you get with an event are logistics,
mm-hmm.
political, hardware. My God, we need to beef this up so we can stand on it. How do you handle half a dozen hundred motorcycles coming into a parking lot in a 20-minute span without having 12 of them crash together at the narrow entrance because that's what you're stuck with? You know, and Bill and I, Bill was chair, and I was very deeply involved with and then became co-chair 1 year with an outfit called March of Dimes. And in San Diego, we did a thing called Bikers for Babies.
Mm-hmm.
And we did this thing 4 years, and we were absolutely amazed when they said, well, we don't want to do the fifth year. We had carefully crafted this event with the help of every single motorcycle outfit we could get our hands on.
A lot of support.
And, well, they were involved. We had a table, a conference table at the March of Dimes, and on that table, sitting at that table in a given meeting, would be 20 people from 20 different kinds of clubs. There was the Bandidos were represented, Independents, motorcycle cops, Goldwing Road Riders, the Red and White called and told Bill that, look, we really, really like what you're doing, and we really think this is a good idea, and the best way for us to help is to not show up.
Hmm.
Because where we go, there seems to be a little problem that kind of follows us around. So we're not going to help, but how big a check do you want? And so it was amazing.
Okay.
Because everything was for the babies. Para las niñas was the way we put it. And we knew where the money was going. It was going to the neonatal care unit down at Scripps Hospital in San Diego. But it doesn't matter where the money's going. It just, I love doing this stuff. And I've done it. I was deeply involved with, and a road captain and with Black Sheep Motorcycle Ministry, which is a large and growing ministry riding.
Harley Davidson affiliated, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's HDM, and, you know, Harley Davidson's for Christ. Well, it's not, yeah, it's Black Sheep Motorcycle, Harley Davidson for Christ, and it's motorcycle ministry. And the target group is Harley owner groups, because they're kind of a forgotten thing in the ministry world. Everybody goes after the poor lost one percenter, and you got these guys that they're also lost. You know, when you look at things from a ministerial view, either you're part of us or you're lost. But organizing events, it's always been fun. And to learn how it works and kind of flowchart the thing, and I mean, just, but that's the engineer in me. And that's how I got into engineering, because I like playing big, bad problems. And I've been lucky. 30, 40 years of aerospace engineering, I've been able to touch a bunch of big, bad problems. And
get out of here. 30 to 40 years.
Yeah,
And now I'm just a nomad on two wheels.
No, I'm a broke nomad on two wheels with no retirement income.
None.
All those years were done primarily on contract, and there's no retirement bennies.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
But
can I ask you guys if we could pick this up Thursday?
Yeah.
I hate to cut you off because we're really going into some deep water here, but I'm getting an evil look over my shoulder.
All right, guys.
Tell me that's your dog giving you the look, not your wife, right?
Yeah.
I sent you that email.
I'll talk to you guys.
All right. Thanks, Phil.
All right. Good night, guys.
Like to hear from you soon.
Give me an email.
Give me a call. All right.
Okay.